Welcome to China Money Podcast, your source for local insights and knowledge on investing in China. Remember to go to our website at chinamoneypodcast.com for more great episodes. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Our guest today is Tom De La Tour, Chief Executive Officer at Beijing-based Central Bridge Capital. He's talking to me here in Hong Kong. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Nina.
So maybe give us first a brief introduction of Central Capital.
Central Bridge Capital is a Beijing-based company. We focus on investing in Tier 2 cities with regional developers to build housing that the middle class can afford.
Why focusing on Tier 2 cities?
Well, if you look, you have to back up a little bit, and if you look at China over the last 6 years, from 2006 to 2010, when you were having price increases in cities like Beijing and Shanghai that was growing at a very rapid rate, in the Tier 2 cities, you had housing prices growing at about 11.9% a year, but household income was growing at 13.1%. So you actually had the affordability for housing for the middle class in the Tier 2 cities to really stay stable or actually slightly improve. Tier 2 cities historically had only had about 10% of their buyers be speculators and 90% were owner-occupants. And so what happened in the last year in Tier 2 cities is prices grew from about 3 to 7%, depending on which city, but household income was growing at 12 to 14%. So actually, the affordability improved in those cities. Now, you read a lot in the press about how prices have dropped dramatically and how volume has dropped dramatically, and that is definitely true in parts of the Tier 1 cities, and has happened in a few Tier 2 cities. But the bulk of the Tier 2 cities actually had larger volume, although slightly, but still a very big number, and had slight price increase, but better household income increase. So the basic dynamics of the supply-demand in those markets is very stable, and there's still today a tremendous pent-up demand for housing the middle class can afford.
When we talk about Tier 2 cities, sometimes the definition can be vague. So how are you defining Tier 2 cities here?
I think most people start with a McKinsey report that was done back, I believe, in 2005. But I think the answer is there's some cities that McKinsey would call Tier 3 that we might call Tier 2 because it has a population of 7 or 8 million people and has a medium household income that's equal to the Tier 2 cities. But for most people, when you talk about Tier 2 cities, they usually like capital cities of the provinces, but we're usually talking about cities from 5 to 10 million people.
Now, there are many different investment strategies when investing in Chinese property. You can either take a minority stake, majority stake, or form a joint venture, or making onshore or offshore investments. What are the pros and cons for each, and what's your preferred strategy?
Well, for those people who do the offshore, the ease of offshore is someone else must have already had a structure in place, and so getting your money invested is a simpler process. But you're actually separated from the real asset, so that has risk associated. Then you can do an onshore investment, and most people do some form of contractual joint venture with the developer. And depending on investors, they may put 70-80% of the equity up, or maybe they only put 40% and have the developer put up 60%. But you have better control rights if you're onshore. And if you're doing a property type in a city that needs that property, and middle class housing is a great example, then the government does want foreign direct investment. So your approval process is an administrative process. It takes time, but it will not be unreasonably withheld. And that's also true that once you exit the investment 2, 3, 4 years later, you'll also have a process. It's administrative, but not there'll be no artificial withholding of approval.
And what's your favorite or most often employed strategy?
Well, for us, we prefer the Tier 2 cities. We like capital cities of provinces. We like to do transactions that are in the small to medium size, 200 to 300,000 square meters, heavy residential, maybe a very small retail component. And we like sites that are near the inner city core. We don't want to be on the outskirts. And by doing the smaller transactions, we also don't have to compete with the large national listed developers or the large state-owned developers because they prefer deals much larger.
And when you do joint venture investments with local Chinese partners, how do you manage to make sure that the interests are aligned between the local partners and investors like you?
Well, this is a very critical question. In fact, the panel that I moderated this morning at the PREA was actually on this very topic. And the consensus is that you want the developer to also put some equity in. And there was a difference of opinion how much is enough, 20%, 50%. But you want to make sure that the developer has equity involved. And then most foreign investors want to have some kind of situation where they get a preference or get their money out quicker, but they're willing to give much more upside to that developer. But once again, it varies. But I think the key thing is to have that investor also put equity in, so it's a significant investment for him as well, or her.
So when you do make joint venture investments, how do you make sure and ensure that you have the control that you want?
Well, you clearly have to do it in your contractual joint venture, and that's a document that's actually approved by the local government before your money can come in. And then I would say most foreign investors will usually put a on-site representative on site to observe what's going on a daily basis, and most foreign investors will control the financial CHOP, so they're actually controlling all cash disbursements. And for those who are not familiar with the financial CHOP, it's in essence the ability to sign all the checks.
Right. The CHOP is definitely very important when doing business in China. And so right now, Chinese property market, there are a lot of concerns, both transaction volumes and prices in some parts of the market have been declining. How big a concern do you think a downturn would be?
Well, I think what you've had over the last 18 months in China is the government has put a restriction in place where really only buyers who are owner-occupants are the large bulk of the buyers. So what we're seeing now is true organic demand, as I would call it. And what you're also seeing is pricing that's in some markets has started to drop a little bit. Some markets staying stable or some increasing ever so slightly. And then in a few markets where you did have the heavy investor demand previously, then you've seen some significant drop in prices. But you know, China is the second largest economy in the world. It has numerous cities that have over 5 million people, which there's really not that many cities in the world that have over 5 million people. So you have very large markets. And even within those different cities, you could make a compelling case that one city is a great market if you go maybe to the southwest portion of that city, but you could also go to the northeast portion and say it's way oversupplied, yet they're an hour and 15 minute drive from each other. So you have to, you know, real estate is location, location, location. So you have to be very specific in looking at your opportunities.
So now China's central bank has cut bank reserve ratios twice already, and there's more signs that the Chinese government will loosen both its monetary policy and potentially some people are expecting its tight grip on the property market as well. What's your outlook?
Well, I think as far as the loosening the grip for investors to invest, I think that'll be very slow to come back. I think the Chinese government likes what's been occurring. We, as investors in the middle class, like what it's done to the market, and we think it's very healthy. In regards to the loosening, the Chinese government did so much tightening on the reserve requirements, it'll need to release or loosen many more times before it gets back to the similar liquidity. But I think the Chinese government is very wise in the fact that they do things slowly. They do it step by step. They don't overreact in either direction. And so I think you'll gradually see more liquidity come in the market. But as far as the restrictions on the investor buyer, that restriction may be in for a while. And I actually think it's a healthy thing for the market. And it's a very good thing for the middle class buyer, because it keeps downward pressure on land prices and it keeps housing affordable for the middle class.
So you don't agree with many projections which says maybe latter half of this year we might see some kind of loosening?
Loosening
on the property market.
If the loosening is regarding allowing the investors to come back and invest, then I would be in the camp that says I think the Chinese government will be very cautious before they loosen that restriction.
So now looking out into the future, how fast do you think Tier 2 cities, its residential property market, is going to keep that kind of rapid growth we have seen in the past years? And how will your investment strategy evolve with that?
Well, I think first of all, our investment strategy is really geared towards the growth of the middle class in the Tier 2 cities and really the Tier 3 cities as well. And remember, when you've seen price growth in those cities over the last 6 years, the economy and household income has been growing faster than the price growth. So that's a very healthy growth. Some people look at China and the price growth and they try to compare it to the United States. Well, all the housing price growth in the United States was solely based on being able to get 100% mortgages. In China, the maximum mortgage is 70% with a 30% down payment. And our experience has been about a third of the buyers pay all cash, a third of the buyers take the full mortgage of 70%, and a third of the buyers will make a down payment larger than 30%. So the markets really are not similar in any way because of the low leverage in China, as well as the economic growth has been the driver in prices.
And now, lastly, you've made your money as investors. What are some challenges regarding repatriating that money offshore, and how do you manage that?
Well, it's very interesting. If you bring the money in correctly and legally through the proper channels, and you're investing in product type that the government encourages and wants, which they clearly want more middle class housing, then the repatriation process is an administrative process, and it's timely. I've heard horror stories, you know, everybody's heard horror stories, and when you dig deeper into these stories, usually somebody was doing an investment the government really was not encouraging, or they didn't bring their money in through the proper channels. The Chinese government's very consistent that if you follow their administrative process, then you can get the proper approvals. But if you try to do something against their will, then you're going to run into problems. And one of our strategies has always been, let's make sure we stay in the middle of what the Chinese government wants. And we believe now and long term, the growth of the middle class, taking care of the middle class, and housing is one of those things, as well as jobs and education and health. That's a very important thing to the government.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
That's today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have any questions or comments, go to our website, chinamoneypodcast.com, where you can see more episodes with other great guests. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thank you so much. Until next time.